Welcome back, bitches. My name is Brittany. This is Heard of a Murder. And if you were listening from episode one, you like the pain like we do, baby. was that cheesy? Yeah. Of course it was. That's just who I am.
Dear Lord.
All right. Who else do we have here today?
We have Patrick here. Mm-hmm. Say hi, Patrick.
Hello.
And myself, Christina.
Yeah.
And we are super pumped for this, for our second episode.
I was really excited the whole week thinking about recording because as nervous as I was last week, I had so much fucking fun, dude. Like, I really had a blast. I don't know about you guys.
No, I had a lot of fun.
I think we started off the episode incredibly nervous, and you can kind of tell. And we did have a lot of feedback from a lot of listeners, which I really appreciate. And then a few people were like, you could tell you were nervous. And I was like, fuck yeah, I was. I was super nervous. But as we loosened up throughout the episode, I think that really reflected in the podcast. Mm-hmm. So I feel like we're still going to present as nervous. And I hope everybody goes through the journey with us because we will get increasingly better. And we'll start getting better with our rapport with each other. And
oh, absolutely.
Kind of learning cues and stuff like that. But
yep.
And I tell everyone, like, that first episode was supposed to kind of be a practice
episode. It was supposed to be a practice.
So, you know, we decided to drop it anyways, like, because, like, what the hell? Why not? I mean,
true.
You know?
Yeah.
It
wasn't as bad as we thought.
If you can't be with us at our worst, then you don't deserve us at our best. Oh, dear. Okay. So, I'm really excited about this week's case. And I know we talked about it last week with the Maria Pisano case. I think this is a crazy case that really needs to be covered. A lot of podcasts cover somewhat of the same quote unquote unknown homicides, but you'll see it kind of a little common. I've never heard the Maria Pisano covered by another podcast. Obviously, there is a book that was written by a Lieutenant Mark Bingaman with the Kings County Sheriff's Office on Maria Pisano. But besides that, and maybe one, what was it, the Usual Suspects episode on ID Discovery that covered it, you don't hear anything about it. But the facts and circumstances around this case are incredibly crazy.
Yeah.
And it's honestly you can't even write a movie about it because it's just so insane about like how these events unfold. So, yeah, I mean, it's a really good case to cover. It's extremely sad and, heartbreaking, but at the same time, I feel like it needs to be kind of put out there.
For me, I feel like, well, obviously all the cases are sad, but this one's super sad to me only because, well, just like you, we're both from that town and I remember this unfolding.
Yeah. Yeah. So for our listeners out there, this case hits close to home for Christina and I because it takes place in a town called Lemoore, which is where her and I grew up. Patrick grew up 10 miles east of Lemoore. Yeah,
but I actually don't know anything about this case.
Yeah. So the town that Patrick grew up in is called Hanford. And Hanford will be referenced a couple times during this podcast because of certain facts and, you know, relevance to the city of Lemoore. So Lemoore, so for those of you who are not local, hopefully we'll get that big to where people who are not local are listening to this podcast. But Lemoore's a small rural town. It's located in Central California. It's about 30 miles south of Fresno and 77 miles north of Bakersfield, if that helps any. There is a naval air base located on the outskirts of Lemoore, which gives the town a heavy military presence. I know growing up, there was a lot of military people that...
Yeah.
And you can identify them quickly, right? Mm-hmm. Like you had them, we called them mandals, like the man sandals. They always had a wristwatch. They were clean shaven and they always like kind of traveled in groups, you know?
I feel like they all had the same haircut.
Yes.
Like the exact same haircut.
It was like a tapered, right? Like Patrick, I know you know haircuts better than we do, but it's like almost like a tapered.
I think they just have to do a high and tight being in the Navy.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, it can be a taper. But I mean, it's got to be a high and tight for their uniform and stuff like that.
So those, Lemoore is very heavy in military personnel. And Lemoore, like I said, is rural. So we have a lot of agriculture in Lemoore. The Central Valley itself is a lot of agriculture. So we have a lot of fields of like cotton, corn. Alfalfa, corn. And there's
a lot of dairies.
A lot of cow dairies. Yeah, that's funny you say that because I do have that on my notes. So a lot of people think of California as like either the beach.
yeah, Lemoore is like that.
Yeah, we're far from it. And there are no celebrities in Lemoore. We do have one casino, and that's about it. So our story is going to center around 8-year-old Maria Pisano. And she lives with her mother in Lemoore. Her mother's name is Arcelia. She has a 6-year-old sister, Lucero, and a 2-year-old brother named Christian. Now, Maria is described as quiet and shy, but she does have a lot of friends. Her mother said she was thoughtful and caring and said she wanted to be a doctor when she grew up. Maria's sister describes their relationship as incredibly close. They often would have sleepovers in each other's rooms and were like best friends. And there was a documentary where her sister said they would always share Barbies, which I feel like for like a, you know, 2-year difference when you're that young, if you share like your toys with each other.
Yeah.
You guys are pretty close. Now, Monday, March 27th, 1995 is where this case begins. Maria's mom was making her and her sister tuna sandwiches after school one day, and then her mom realizes that they're out of tuna. So Maria, being the thoughtful and caring child that she is, she volunteers to go across the street to the food market to go purchase a can of tuna. So her mom gives her $3 exactly, and Maria leaves the apartment. Now, this is at about 3:10 p.m., now, her mom remembers her wearing green pants, a pink long sleeve shirt, and black shoes. Now, the food market that Maria goes to is called a Food King, and it was located in a small shopping mall. And from what I remember, because I used to shop at the Food King when I lived in Lemoore, was there was like a laundromat, there was a 99 cent store, there was a video store slash arcade. I don't know if you guys remember that was a thing, you know, RIP video stores.
You know what's crazy about this is when you think about it, like nowadays, like I would never send my daughter to the store, like even if it like she's 9, even if it was right across the street, like I would not be okay with that.
Yes,
but again, this was a while back, times were different.
Well, and, I think that was
a norm.
These moments right here caused us not to let our kids go do that stuff, you know.
Yeah,
100%.
Like I used to go ride my bike wherever to go get groceries for my mom, or I mean, I could go a couple miles, no big deal, but no way would I let my kids nowadays do that.
It was like what we talked about in the first episode, like with hitchhiking. No one thought anything of it, but now in retrospect, you know, that's like a entirely dangerous, I don't want to say hobby, but pastime or way to get around.
So you're trying to say I'm not supposed to let people hitchhike?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to. I'm not going to lie if I don't say I've ever wanted to pick up a hitchhiker, but then you have that other side of the fence that's like, well, that person could be a murderer. The hitchhiker could, you know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah. But it was common, and especially, and I hate to be that cliche person with Lemoore, but it really was such a small and safe town. Yeah. I used to ride my bike with my siblings and kids down the street, and I grew up in the country, so it wasn't like we were surrounded by a lot of like houses or buildings. But at the same time, my parents never worried. And it was the typical, like, you better not come home until the sun goes down, but you better be home by the time it gets dark kind of yeah. thing. So Maria takes off to the Food King, the shopping mall. And like I said, she leaves at 3:10 p.m. Now, after about 30 minutes of Maria being gone, her mom starts to worry because this Food King should be only about a 5-minute walk. So you think 5 minutes there. Maybe it takes her 5-10 minutes to get the can of tuna and then check out, yeah. and then 5 minutes to walk back. So 30 minutes is entirely too long. So her mom starts to stress out. She takes her other 2 children and immediately goes to the Food King to look for Maria. And she goes down every aisle. She says she asks every personnel in the building, asks customers if they've seen her, and nobody has seen Maria. So she immediately calls the police. And the police come to the store. They, at the same time that they come to the store, they have other police officers searching local parks, surrounding stores, and nobody comes up with anything. Now, when they talk to employees from the store, one cashier specifically remembers checking out for a little girl that matches the same description of Maria. And she says that Maria, or the little girl that she remembers, did buy a can of tuna. And they were able to produce a receipt from the store, the register, that shows a can of tuna that was bought at exactly 3:18 p.m. So with that timeline, it's 8 minutes after Maria leaves her apartment.
Yeah, so it lines up. It has to be her.
Yeah. So the town immediately responds because this is a rare occasion where a little girl goes missing. So all surrounding agencies were on high alert looking for Maria. The entire area up to a 10-mile radius was searched. And we're talking fields, apartment complexes, canals, like just every street and nook and cranny that police could search, they searched. Police canvassed the town with flyers, posters. I don't know if you remember, Christina, but there's a huge billboard put up in Lemoore.
Yeah, right there by the complex.
Yes, it literally across the street from Maria's apartment where she lived. And it was your typical, like, have you seen me? And it had her picture on it. And just to describe Maria, because she's such a beautiful little girl at 8 years old, she had long, dark hair, your basic kindergarten bangs. And then she was smiling really wide and she had that huge toothy smile where her right tooth on the front was missing.
Yeah.
And it just kind of gave her that like innocent look. And it was heartbreaking. Like I was 6 years old at the time Maria went missing. So that was like almost a terrifying reminder every time we drove past that billboard. Cause Lemoore's so small, like wherever you go, you're going to pass that.
Oh, absolutely. You know what? As crazy as we actually went to the same elementary school.
Really?
Yeah, she went to PW Ingvall, and as I did, and I was a grade older than her. I do not remember her at all. I don't remember playing with her or anything, but I remember her going to the same school as me.
So that's got to be terrifying.
Yeah, like, no, it definitely was.
Literally hits close to home. Like this little girl that went to my school is missing. You know, we all think that could have been me.
Mm-hmm.
So. Immediately, this little girl going missing transitions, like we were talking about before, the town of Lemoore from a safe town to like literally parents keeping their children like close to the chest and prohibiting them from like all these activities that required them to, you know, be gone from their parents' eyesight for a long time. So police were trying to knock out a couple theories. They did explore really briefly, though, just to kind of get it out of the way, the fact that she could have ran away. But talking to family and friends, they said that she was a really happy kid. And there's a picture that still circulates the internet. And it's a picture that Maria drew of herself. And she's smiling. There is like a sun above her with like rays of light shining down. She has circles on her cheeks, almost like she's blushing. Yes. So obviously this picture depicted her in a real positive light versus other children who like are unhappy with their home life. And you see that in the way they draw the pictures of themselves. So then police started looking at suspects. And of course, with any case with a missing child, they look close to home. So the first suspect that police looked at was Maria's father. His name was Jorge Peroso, and he was about 35 years old at the time. Now, Jorge lived with Maria, her mother, and her younger sister up until she was 5 years old. And Maria's mother and Jorge did not get along very well. In fact, Arcelia and Jorge often got into verbal disputes that escalated to physical altercations. So this led Arcelia, Maria's mother, to filing a restraining order on Jorge. And she actually was successful in obtaining one. And she actually was able to obtain a permanent restraining order.
Oh, wow.
Which I've never heard of. Usually they're about, like, what, 7 years long before you have to refile. This one's a permanent restraining order, which is incredibly difficult from the research I did. Now, something really interesting is 3 weeks prior to Maria going missing, Jorge showed up to Arcelia and Maria's apartment, and Arcelia and Jorge got in a fight. And Jorge threatened to take Maria to Mexico. And so obviously when Arcelia reported this to the police, it got them on high alert. And then all of a sudden, authorities are speculating that Maria's en route to Mexico. And of course, with going over the border, it's a potential that she'll never be heard from again. So they immediately notified Border Patrol, and California had a liaison with Mexico, and they notified them, and they were trying everything they could in their power to intercept Maria before she went across the border. Now, at the same time, they're obviously trying to locate Jorge, who resided in Sparks, Arizona, and they were able to obtain an address for Jorge, but when they raided his house, they didn't find any Jorge and no Maria. They did find lots of drugs and lots of money.
Of course.
Interesting.
Yes. So simultaneously, when they're trying to look for Jorge, Maria's mother, and I can fucking respect this to the utmost extent, she's like, you know, I know police are doing their job, but I'm not going to sit back and not try to look for my daughter. So she knows that Jorge's girlfriend lives in Huron, and Huron's approximately 20 miles west of Lemoore. It's a even smaller town than Lemoore. And she finds Jorge's girlfriend. Jorge's girlfriend will not give up Jorge's location, but Arcelia breaks down. She begs, she pleads, she cries. And finally, Jorge's girlfriend, feeling sorry for her, tells her, like, listen, he's in jail. He got arrested weeks ago and he's in Nevada in a jail. Hmm. So police follow up on this, and at first they're not able to locate him, and they're thinking that Jorge's girlfriend was lying. But then after some, like, real close investigations, they found out that he was incarcerated in Reno, Nevada in a jail, and he was under the alias of Roberto Lopez.
Hmm.
So then they found out that he was there on, shocker, drug charges, and that he had been arrested prior to Maria going missing. But this didn't rule him out as a suspect immediately, because he had a brother, Maria's uncle. His name was Emilio, and he lived in the city of Lemoore. And talking to people, Emilio and Maria, like, had a good relationship. Mm-hmm. So police speculated that Emilio could have easily intercepted her on the way to Food King, kidnapped her, and then took her to Mexico. And I feel like with every podcast that's doing murder, we should have rules, right? Or, like, you know, we should have, like, a little, like, list of things that we should mention. And like I said, the last episode, people in society can fucking suck sometimes, because Arcelia, Maria's mom, was receiving anonymous phone calls that said that Maria was en route to Mexico and she was going to be given to Jorge's parents, and they lived in central Mexico.
Wow.
So that's where it kind of lined up for police, mm-hmm. in addition to him making those threats, right, to take her to Mexico. So they theorized that Emilio took her across the border to Jorge's parents, or and Emilio's parents. So when they talked to Emilio, he was nowhere in town during the time Maria went missing.
What kind of person would make that phone call?
Yeah, who the fuck does that?
Well, they said they had several phone calls.
Who the fuck does this?
Yeah.
Like,
what kind of person sees this, like, horrible situation unfolding and thinks, you know what, I'm just going to call the mom who's in distraught in the worst situation of her life, and I'm going to basically lead him off a beaten path. And I feel like at the same time that these people should be fucking tracked down and charged.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Well, some of them could be a family member and they said, hey, have you ever thought about this idea? But if people actually told her, like, they're like, I know they're going to Mexico, they're fucked up.
Yeah,
like,
that's really fucked up.
They don't know shit.
I think it's fucked up just because, one, you're playing off their emotions, but two, you're literally hindering the investigation. So absolutely, you're leading the police elsewhere when they could be really focusing on somewhere that Maria could actually be.
Yeah.
And you see this time and time again in a lot of investigations. Like the last one, I mean, with the Cowden family murders, I'm sure people really did think they saw him in Seattle. But like in this one, like there's no mistaking it. People were blatantly saying stuff that wasn't true.
Right.
Right. So they did contact Jorge's parents in Mexico. They got authorities to go to their house, and they were very genuine in telling police, like, listen, we haven't talked to Jorge in forever, and I promise we have no part in Maria's abduction, and we know nothing about this plan. Okay, so with Jorge and Emilio ruled out as suspects, the next person that police looked at was Maria's mom's boyfriend. So Arcelia was dating a man named Alfredo at the time. And Alfredo was the father to Maria's little brother, the 2-year-old Christian. And so Alfredo did not live with Maria or her family. But when investigators talked to friends and family, they claimed that Alfredo did not like Maria or her little sister because there was that stigma that they weren't his biological children. And apparently they got in the way with his relationship with Christian.
What a dick.
Yeah, and I couldn't find
ridiculous.
I couldn't find any information that said, like, how they got in the way, and I don't know how somebody would get in the way, like, but that's what was claimed.
Well, like you said, people are shitty. So he may just be one of those shitty people.
So shitty. Now, Alfredo was very cooperative with police, and they asked him to take a polygraph test, and he did. Now, he passed the polygraph test with flying colors. But for all our listeners out there, I would like to kind of describe the use of polygraph tests because I think there is a misconception on them. Patrick, you're really good with, you know, law enforcement and stuff. Can you describe the use of polygraph tests?
No, I don't know anything about it.
Okay. I thought you were going to Google it right now when you pulled out your phone.
No.
See, and I thought you know everything. So I thought, okay, so polygraph tests for our listeners out there, they don't necessarily damn somebody as far as being guilty or make somebody innocent if they pass it, right? So polygraph tests aren't an exact science as far as if somebody's guilty or if they're innocent. They're merely an investigative tool to lead investigators or to kind of like assist with the investigation, if that makes any sense. Because somebody who's guilty could easily pass a polygraph test. Somebody who's innocent could fail a polygraph test because it goes off of your vitals. So I just want that known, because that's a huge, huge misconception, is that polygraph tests like are super like specific. Like if they fail it, they're guilty. If they pass it, they're innocent.
Well, that's why they're not admissible in court.
Correct. Now, in addition to the polygraph test, police searched Alfredo's car. And initially, they did find some, they called it bodily fluids that they deemed kind of suspicious. I couldn't find exactly what bodily fluids they were referring to, but when they were analyzed, like nothing was found to be suspicious. But I feel like as a parent, you're going to have bodily fluids in your car. Like kids,
true.
Correct. And police were able also to eliminate him as a suspect because apparently he was testifying in Fresno, which is, you know, like what we talked about is north of Lemoore. And he was testifying in court as a witness in a criminal case. Hmm. So that's a pretty legitimate alibi. You're literally
absolutely
on the record as being there. So with those two people ruled out, the next thing that police did was they looked at registered sex offenders in the area. Do you guys want to guess how many registered sex offenders were in Kings County?
Fuck. 5 million.
I'm going to say 600.
25 to
30. Oh.
There were, I guess at that time.
95. Yeah. 25 to 30 registered sex offenders, which is nothing. I mean, it's a lot, you know, for sex offenders, but in, you know, it's not very many.
We're over here saying like 5,600,000. Like, I guess we think everyone's a sex offender.
Everybody is a sex offender. I'm not gonna lie. When I go through a store, like every guy that looks at my child and waves is a fucking sex offender. That guy could be like just super sweet and like just a genuine person, but you're a fucking sex offender. That's horrible that we think that way.
Yeah, don't wave at my fucking kids. Don't wave at my kids. Unless you're related, just look the other way.
We're such horrible just people.
Look the other way. Absolutely.
Like, we do not have the good side of humanity on our minds.
No.
For sure. We're like, so jaded.
I'm pushing, you know, my daughter will be in the cart and they're like, oh my God, she's so cute. Like, don't fucking look at her. Leave me alone.
She's cute.
Yeah, but people don't even tell me that. Just keep walking.
Sorry, guys. I'm texting Birdo for a drink.
Oh, my Lord.
I'm really hoping that White Claw ends up sponsoring me. White Claw, if you're out there and you hear me, I love your seltzer. Anyways, so to continue on our investigation, we'll see if Berto comes and brings me a White Claw. Lemoore PD knew that they were a small agency and they had limited resources, so they called in the FBI to assist with the investigation. When the FBI came in, they looked at all of the circumstances and the evidence that they had before them, and then they were able to create a profile of who the police were looking for. Because at this point, with everybody close to the family ruled out, the scary thing comes, it becomes relevant, and it's a stranger abduction, which is terrifying, right? Oh, there he is. Berto to save the day. Thanks, boyfriend.
Aww.
I have to edit all this out.
I can't stand you right now.
Did you want one?
No, thank you.
Okay. So with nothing turning up at the Food King or the shopping center, police shifted their focus to Maria's apartment complex, and they had some tips that pointed in the direction of a man named Rich Rayburn. And Mitch Rayburn was like a handyman around the complex, and people described him as kind of odd and that he paid a lot of extra attention to the children in the complex, which is, in retrospect, with the little girl going missing, a huge red flag. So when police dug into Mitch Rayburn, they found out that he actually did not show up to work the day that Maria disappeared.
Wow.
So they were able to obtain an address for Mitch Rayburn. And when they went to his residence, his wife answered the door and they started asking her questions. And his wife told police, well, he didn't show up to work because he just had a major surgery the day before Maria disappeared, which was March 26th of 95. And he's been in the hospital ever since. Police were able to verify her claims, and he was ruled out as a suspect as well.
Yeah, it's a pretty good alibi.
Yeah, in the hospital. Not as good as court.
No.
Not as good as court.
Because you're literally on the record.
So the next suspect that police had they received from Lemoore Naval Air Station, that the naval base in Lemoore. The NCIS team ended up contacting Lemoore PD and telling them that they had reports of a man named Sam Grant, and he had been reported as chasing kids in his car around the area of Lemoore.
Chasing them around?
Yeah, like chasing kids down with his fucking car.
What the fuck?
So,
like, to the point where he was trying to run them over?
I don't know. So I don't know the specifics of, and that wasn't even my initial question. My initial question was it in Lemoore Naval Air Station, like the Naval Air Base? Because if it was on base, they would have arrested him, because the MPs on base don't play. So from what it sounds like is it was in the town of Lemoore, and why would the NCIS have information that Lemoore PD wouldn't have? And as I dug deeper into that, I couldn't find any answers.
Hmm.
But I felt it, like, even like normally I would leave this part out, but I find it relevant because this guy's a fucking weirdo. And I'm going to tell you guys right now, because police talked to his neighbors and they described him as a loner. And then he also matched the FBI's description of him being white and in his 30s. And when police searched his home, they found collages of women throughout his house. And I mean, this guy fucking cut out pictures of women from magazines and newspapers and pasted them up on his walls. And a lot of them were very young, to the point where they were almost like unsure if they were even of age or not. And when they asked this guy, Sam Grant, about it, he wasn't embarrassed. He wasn't shy. He was proud of it and called it his quote unquote art. And then but police couldn't do anything because all the women were fully clothed. So there was no pornography involved. But it was just weird. I mean, you can't arrest someone for being fucking weird. So nothing came up with this guy. Like, there was nothing that linked him to Maria. They searched his whole residence. There was no evidence found. So they literally had to, like, pretty much put him aside as a suspect. I would like to make note that all these suspects that the police looked through was within 1 week of Maria going missing.
That's a lot of leads, honestly.
It is. And,
like, well, dead ends, too.
It's a lot of resources, but it's a lot of work for 1 week.
Mm-hmm.
So to say that they didn't hit the ground running would be, like, I feel like a false allegation.
Mm-hmm.
Because you do have a lot of newspaper articles that basically said that, like, police were almost, like, derelict in their duties and didn't really do all that they could. But I feel like that's a lot of work to do, especially with, I mean, what we talked about in the last podcast was Lemoore has about a population of, what, like, 25,000 people now, which was even less in 1995. So it's going to be a small town police department. They're not going to have a lot of personnel, not a lot of resources. So to have such a huge case like this is big. And they did have a lot of help from the Kings County Sheriff's Office, but it's still a small county, so they're not gonna have too much going on, you know?
And you know what, too? I'm sure there's other crimes going on 100%. During that time. It's not just going to be, like, I understand the main focus is to find this little girl, but there are other, you know, crimes that are occurring that they need to try to solve. Yes. Or stop. Or
I'm sure she's at the forefront of,
yeah,
their priority list, but at the same time, like you said, life goes on as usual. So 2 weeks after Maria's disappearance, it's April 9th, 1995, a group of young men, they are rafting in Poso Creek, which is located in Bakersfield, California, when they come across a little girl's body. Now, this little girl was fully clothed. She was wearing the same pink long-sleeved shirt and green pants that Maria was wearing. And when police came and responded to the scene, they were able to immediately identify the little girl as being Maria Pisano. Now, the only thing that Maria was missing was her shoes. But she did have the exact amount of change in her pocket after she would have bought a can of tuna with $3. And she also had the Food King receipt in her pocket they discovered her.
And how long after was this?
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Now, later, when the creek dried up, investigators would search the creek and they would discover a bowling ball and a peach shower curtain, which they theorized that the shower curtain was obviously used to wrap her up.
Mm-hmm.
And then the bowling ball was used to weigh her down. So Kern County, which is Bakersfield's located in Kern County Coroner's Office conducted an autopsy on little Maria, and they determined her cause of death to be suffocation. She also sustained blunt force injuries to her body, but they did not contribute to her death. There were also findings that suggested possible sexual abuse, which we'll find out later. Like, she absolutely was sexually abused. And then based off of decomposition of her body, along with other forensic evidence, suggested Maria was estimated to have been dead for about 2 weeks. So around the time that Maria went missing, it wasn't long after that, you know, she was killed. Now, at the time that Maria went missing, police couldn't help but link her to another case. And there was a little girl named Angelica Ramirez. Almost exactly a year before Maria went missing, she went missing from Visalia, California. Now, Visalia is about 30 minutes east of Lemoore. And this little girl lived in Hanford, but her and her mom went to a swap meet in Lemoore. Now, Angelica Ramirez went to the bathroom and she never returned. 2 days later, her body was discovered in an irrigation canal just 40 miles away from where Maria's body was found. Now, she too had been sexually assaulted and died as a result of strangulation. Now, like I said before, Maria died from suffocation. This little girl died of strangulation, which is kind of the same manner of death, but slightly different.
I want to say around this time, too, there was a girl in Hanford. What was her name?
Tracy Renee Conrad.
Yes.
Yes, I will touch on that too, because that is incredibly important to the Maria Piseño case as well. But this Angelica Ramirez was also found to be nude from the waist down. Now, I am going to send you guys in the group or Heard of a Murder group. I'm going to send you guys two pictures. Now, the two pictures are going to be the picture of Angelica Ramirez and the picture of Maria Piseño. And I want you guys to, like, tell me kind of what you see with these two little girls when you're looking at them. Now, that's Angelica Ramirez that you're looking at. Now, please describe her.
These are two separate?
They're two separate girls.
Oh, they look super close.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say identical, but very close.
Long, dark like hair. Sisters. Around the same age.
Yeah.
Same height.
Missing tooth.
The missing right tooth. And so from an investigator's point of view, they died in almost the same manner. They were both dumped in almost like water-related dump sites, just 40 miles from each other. They lived literally within 10 miles apart from each other. It's hard not to think that these two cases are linked.
They're so young. It really breaks my heart too.
So like, Angelica was 10 years old when she went missing. Now, I want to talk to you guys about Donna Holmes. Right. So we haven't talked about her in this case yet. Donna Holmes was at her residence in Bakersfield when she sees the news that broadcasts Maria's body being found in Poso Creek, California. Now, she immediately calls investigators after watching the broadcast to tell them that she believes her brother committed this murder. Now, police ask her, why do you believe that he committed this murder? Now, she tells them a crazy story. Donna's brother's name is Gene McCurdy. Gene McCurdy is a first-class petty officer, and he currently is stationed at the Lemoore Naval Air Station in Lemoore. Growing up, her brother repeatedly sexually assaulted her, sometimes beat her, but most of her sexual abuse lasted for about 13 years of her life.
Wow.
She also told investigators that Gene would play at Poso Creek when he was a child, and that was his favorite places to go hang out with friends. And she also told him that when she became an adult, Gene would show up to a lot of family functions, and he would a lot of times play with the little kids, and she would keep an eye on him because she knew that he had kind of a fetish for children. Mm-hmm. And she confronted him when she was an adult, and she basically confronted him about the sexual abuse that she sustained. And when she confronted Gene, he apologized for all of it. And he told her he was incredibly sorry. And he did tell her that's the reason he wasn't married. That's the reason he didn't have kids, because he feared that when he had children, or if he had children, that he would end up sexually assaulting them.
Oh, wow.
Now, Donna says that when she tells investigators that when she sees this broadcast, she almost felt like Maria was screaming at her that her brother did this. And she felt very compelled to tell investigators that her brother was the culprit in this situation. So obviously, as an investigator, there's a couple things that match up. I mean, he played at Postal Creep where her body was dumped. He worked at Naval Air Station in Lemoore. But besides that, it's what circumstantial evidence for the most part.
Yeah.
But they decide, hey, it's worth a look. So investigators wanted to interview Gene McCurdy, but he was deployed on the USS Abraham Lincoln, which is an aircraft carrier, which was en route to the Persian Gulf. So this guy was in the middle of the fucking ocean when police wanted to investigate him. They ended up getting a hold of an NCIS agent who was aboard the USS Lincoln. And she's able to locate Gene McCurdy, and she calls him to her office. And when she calls him to her office, she asks him, do you know why you're here? And you know what he tells her? Is it because of that little girl that went missing?
What?
Fuck.
So when she kind of asks him why he thinks that, he tells her, well, listen, I was at the shopping center the day that she went missing. And I was at the video store renting some videotapes. And when she started pressing him for more questions, that's all McCurdy tells her, is that he doesn't know what happened to Maria. That's just why he figured, because he was in the same kind of area, time and place that Maria was missing. Yeah. And then the NCIS agent tells McCurdy that Maria had been found dead. And his next question was she molested?
Who fucking asked that question?
But really, like, yeah, that's the next question that you ask when they say that. And why are you, like, my thing would be like, why are you questioning me about this right now?
Right.
You know, do you want information? I wouldn't ask, was she molested?
No, absolutely not.
And they reported that he was like super upset. He was shaking. He was crying. And when she asked Gene McCurdy, like, hey, why are you so upset right now? His answer was like, I'm just really stressed out and I recently quit smoking.
Because smoking made you cry. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I feel like that's just like a huge red flag of guilt right there.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, you're a fucking piece of shit.
Well, you already knew it was as soon as, you know, he gets asked a question and dimes himself out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when the NCIS agent, she doesn't try to press him too much because of all obvious like Miranda reasons. So detectives end up flying out to this aircraft carrier in the middle of the ocean to speak with McCurdy. So when they interview Gene, he was super vague in the beginning, denying any involvement in Maria's disappearance. But he did kind of go on and off emotional, like was crying. And then one moment and then the next moment, he was like super stoic and like really cold. And in the course of the interview, when they were asking him about like the shopping center and like his, you know, him being there in that location at the time, at one point, Gene tells them, end quote, I'm afraid if I did see something, I didn't stop it, end quote. Hmm. So investigators press him a little bit more and then they get nothing. But one investigator asks him a huge question. The investigator says, if they found that Maria was, what did he say? Was there a little girl in your truck? Is it possible there's a little girl in your truck when you left? And he said, I don't know. There might have been, but I might be blocking these things out.
What?
Who says shit like that?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
This man's sick.
Yeah.
And twisted.
None of these are answers that you would give if you were completely innocent.
No. Right. No. You would give your fucking alibi.
Yes. So then they asked Gene where he was on the time and date. Not even the time of date, like map his day out on March 27th. So Gene said he woke up, he watched the Maury Povich show, and then he showered and he left his apartment. Now, he lived in the Greenfield Apartments, which, not so fun fact, was within a mile of the Kings County Sheriff's Office, like their headquarters. He stopped to get fast food before he went to a storage unit because Gene was moving out of his apartment because he was going to go on deployment. So he was back and forth from this mini storage. Now, after he was done with the mini storage, he thought to himself, like, hey, I'm in the mood for some fucking porn. So he drove to a video store in Lemoore to rent pornographic movies, which in my mind, why are you driving to Lemoore? Because you live in Hanford.
Yeah.
There's plenty of video stores in Hanford. Why are you driving two towns over to Lemoore to rent movies.
I don't know. It's the only movie store that rents them.
No, there's always porn in every video shop. You don't remember video stores?
Blockbuster didn't it?
We're not talking about Blockbuster. We're not talking about Hollywood Video. We're talking about these like little sketchy shoppy mall video stores.
Yeah, I remember that store, and I want to say even had like a curtain to where you know that shows like that's the area where.
Mm. Oh, 100%. It had the little black curtains.
Yeah.
And then as kids, and you go in the video store, and you like kind of play at the arcade. Then you would like kind of, we would dare each other like to see if we could make it to the back because it had the like 18 and under post. Okay. So I'm going to give you guys a side story right now and it's kind of fucked up and I haven't told you guys the story because I kind of wanted your genuine reaction to this podcast. So it was around the time Maria went missing and we shopped at the Food King. And so my parents were loading groceries in the back of the truck in the parking lot at the Food King. And Maria was still missing at the time. I don't remember if they found her body, but it was literally around the same time as this case was going on. So I was at the back of the car, like in the passenger, like staring at the door for some reason. And all of a sudden, somebody fucking grabs me, right? Grabs me by my waist and starts running away with me. And this person has me like kind of draped over their arm, like you would kind of drape a coat over your arm. And so my head's facing down. Yes. And all I see are like cowboy boots and they're just fucking like hitting pavement and running. And in my head, I'm thinking, what the fuck, dude? I just got fucking kidnapped. This is the same person that took Maria. I'm fucking dead. Bye, mom and dad. Right. It ended up being my goddamn uncle.
Oh, fuck.
Yes. Yeah. And not only that.
If I was your dad, I would have peed the fuck out of
him. No, my dad was in on it. So they wanted to see how I would react because of the whole thing going on in a situation where I would get kidnapped. And I remember being so literally petrified with fear. I couldn't scream. I couldn't move. I couldn't fucking fight. I just remember I was just that terrified because I was 6 years old at the time.
Yeah, you're a little kid.
Yes. And not only that, but my uncle, my mom, and my dad all fucking just started in on me for not reacting at all and said, you could have been gone. You could have been in this man's car and fucking they could have like literally like killed you. Shout out to mom and dad, that's fucked up.
But at 6 years old, that's to me, that's not your responsibility. That's your parents' responsibility.
Yes.
Like,
I don't know why they thought it was a good idea. My parents had some really fucked up like ways of parenting
holy
us.
Shit.
Like I said, we grew up in the country and
if I'm chilling at the grocery store, I understand your dad was in on it. But like if my brother did that, and I didn't know that that's my brother running with my son, he's probably going to catch 2 rounds in the back of his, you know, literally in his back because he's running like with my kid. I'm going to smoke that dude.
Do you trust your aim?
Absolutely.
Not to hit your child?
Absolutely.
I just want to
absolutely
know.
My uncle was very identifiable. He looked like Wyatt Earp, but probably like 20 pounds smaller than him. My uncle's like a really tall, skinny guy. Has the big old handlebar mustache. Has the tight Levi jeans. Like I said, the cowboy boots. Like, super identifiable. And I'm sure it was one of those things because I was facing away that he probably looked at my parents. They probably made eye contact and they, like, made that, like, subconscious agreement to, like, fucking do it. Which,
fuck.
Now looking back in retrospect, hella fucked up.
Yeah.
Hella fucked up. Like I was saying, that was my parents, like, fucking teaching style. Like,
I would still be pissed about it right now. Hey, I'm hella petty, so I'll hold on to that grudge forever.
So my parents were reading an article that like cornfields suffocate children, right? Have you ever heard that?
No.
Children in cornfields like sucks the oxygen out of them. No. So they read this article and they kept telling us because we lived in the country and we had a cornfield across the street, you're not allowed to play in the cornfields. But we did it fucking anyways, right? Because we'd play hide and seek. My parents that night, we go home and they make us watch 3 fucking movies of Children of the Corn.
Oh my God.
That's my parents. Like they rolled off of fear, not respect.
The only thing that...
Sometimes that's the only way.
That's the only way. I didn't do it again.
Yeah, no. You probably cried every time you drive by them now.
Just terrified.
Like, just take the wheel. I'm going to cry while I press the pedal and you drive.
Yes. But yeah, so that was that was a fun little side story. It was a good little palate cleanser for this horrible case. But going back to Gene... with investigators. So investigators had Gene take a polygraph test and Gene agreed. And they had four main questions that they wanted to ask Gene. And those four questions were, did he see Maria on March 27th? Did he touch Maria? Did Maria get into his vehicle? And did Gene drive Maria towards Bakersfield? Now, when Gene took the polygraph test, anyone want to guess?
He passed.
Failed miserably.
No.
Fucking failed. He had deception in every answer. So when police asked Gene about it, he basically just said that Maria's name caused him to be just so emotional because he was so distraught and felt so bad for her parents that just hearing her name caused him to be emotional, which spiked the test.
Plus, he just quit smoking.
Correct. Yeah, that's also a factor, I guess.
Fucking idiot. That's what that guy is.
So investigators tell him, like, look, Gene, how about you take a second polygraph test and we'll eliminate Maria's name since it causes you to go in such, quote, distress. Now, the polygraph examiner was really smart. So he has Gene write down the following statements. One, I did not have any sexual contact with Maria. Two, I did not kill Maria. Three, I did not dump her body in any water. And four, I've never been involved in anything like this before. They had him sign and date the bottom of these, I guess, you know, these little statements.
Sentences?
Statements.
All right.
I mean, either way.
Mm.
Now, I think this is really smart on investigators' end because at the same time, if you think about it, they didn't mention this, but me thinking, looking at this, I'm like, oh, this is almost like, you know, he signs and dates it. It's almost, yeah, almost like a contract. Like it's, yeah, a, like it's a official statement. But anyways, so they asked Gene one question for this polygraph test, the second polygraph test. Did you lie in your written statement? And Gene replied no. And guess what? Failed fucking miserably. Showed deception in this one answer. Now, when investigators prodded Gene about it and said, listen, dude, you fucking failed this test too. And we didn't bring up Maria's name once. We literally just asked you if you lied in your written statement. Gene's response was chilling. Gene tells investigators, well, there's a good side of Gene and a bad side of Gene. And when they ask him about it, Gene says, well, the good side of Gene is afraid the bad side of Gene committed this crime. So wow. He starts referring himself in third person, which as we know is a separation technique.
Mm-hmm.
He's separating himself. It's not him anymore. He's talking about another person. Now, when police asked him, because they started kind of catching on, they're like, well, what would the bad side of Gene do once they had Maria in his truck? And Gene says, well, he would take her through the back door of his apartment and he would take her upstairs to his bedroom. And then he would tell them, you know, and then after she is murdered, he would take her back out the back door. And investigators asked him, well, where would the bad side of Gene take her body? And Gene's response was in the water. Now, investigators asked Gene what his bad side would do once he got rid of the body. And Gene replied, quote, get out of there and go on. Life is normal. End quote.
Wow.
Yeah. He's sick.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. This guy's definitely tormented. He's just deranged in my mind. These alone with no other facts, I'm thinking this guy fucking did it, dude.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. 100%. So with damn near a confession, Gene McCurdy is arrested and brought back to Kings County to stand trial. During the preliminary hearings, investigators start becoming really worried about if they have enough evidence to convict Gene because the judge ruled out a significant amount of investigators' interviews with McCurdy on the aircraft carrier due to Miranda violations.
Of course. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah. And they pretty much ruled out almost all of it. So
wow.
If you take out Gene's interviews, what do you have?
Yeah, no shit.
Circumstantial evidence. So, as Christina mentioned before, about 1 year after Maria's disappearance, this little girl by the name of Tracy Renee Conrad goes missing in the town of Hanford, Patrick's town. And Gene is in custody at the time at the Kings County Jail. So, this gives Gene a really strong defense, giving an alternative theory of a potential child serial killer. because now you have Angelica Ramirez, you have Tracy Renee Conrad, and you have Maria Pisano. All lived either in Hanford or Lemoore, very small towns, and child abduction is not really heard of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the public can only think that there's a child serial killer. And with Jean incarcerated at the time of one of those, it's hard to believe that, you know, he's responsible for all of them.
Right.
If you do subscribe to the child serial killer theory. So investigators, knowing they have a lot of work to do, they don't stop when Jean is arrested. They continue their investigation. Now, KCSO detectives, they start combing through everything that the Lemoore PD had kind of got together. And they found out that on the day that Maria went missing, there was actually a witness or supposed witness to her abduction. Now, a guy named Michael Jackson, spelled with a Y, he came forward about a couple weeks after Maria was abducted and told them that he feels like he saw Maria being taken away by Jean on March 27th of 1995. Now, Michael Jackson's story is that he lives in Visalia. He was going to babysit a friend's children in Lemoore. And when he drove to Lemoore, he remembers that he forgot the apartment key. So he was going to drive back to Visalia to go get it. Now, on his way back, he ended up going and stopping by the Food King to buy some orange juice. Now, when he was in the parking lot, he sees a guy. And he's got sunglasses on and he describes him as having a mustache and he's like super balding and he's crouched behind some kind of van and he's trying to coax a little Hispanic girl over to him. Now, he also describes later seeing this man grab the little girl by her hand and lead her to his truck. And the little girl gets in the truck at the passenger side. The man walks back over to the driver's side and they take off. So when Michael Jackson later saw a broadcast of Maria's abduction, he tells his girlfriend at the time, like, listen, I saw this little girl getting abducted. But Michael Jackson had a lot of run-ins with law enforcement and he didn't trust police officers. So he was really reluctant to come forward. And she finally convinced him, like, listen, you saw a little girl get abducted. You have a civil right to come forward. So he does come forward. Now, police have him Michael Jackson a lineup. And Michael Jackson is able to point out Jean McCurdy's picture. But when he points out Jean McCurdy's picture, he notices that he doesn't have a mustache. And he tells police, he doesn't have a mustache, that's him. But at the time, he had a mustache. Police look into it a little bit further, and they find out that Jean did have a mustache prior to being deployed. And they went and spoke with Jean. And they interviewed him, and not telling him that a witness came forward, they asked him about having a mustache. And Jean claims, yes, I had a mustache, but I shaved it because I didn't want to utilize my electric razor being on board. So I shaved it before I went on the aircraft carrier. Right.
So Michael Jackson came forward when he was already in jail?
So Michael Jackson came forward when he saw Maria's picture broadcasted within a couple weeks of her missing. And then once police apprehended once police apprehended Jean McCurdy was when investigators went through. Because at first when he came forward to police officers, they kind of disregarded his tips because of his his criminal history. And then when they went to go take a second look at the case, investigators were like, hey, why didn't anybody follow up on this fucking lead? And then when they brought him in a second time to talk to him, that's when they found all this information out. And then they went and interviewed Jean and they found all this out. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
But still, like, I know you have run-ins with the cops, but you see a little girl get abducted and you don't immediately call 911. Like, come on, man. Like,
so something that he said, and I can kind of understand this from a criminal's point of view, I guess, is that he feared, because he was black, right? And it's the 90s. And he feared that if he came forward, police would identify him as a suspect. Because remember, when he wasn't coming forward, there was no suspects on the case.
How do you sleep at night, though?
Yeah.
Like, honestly, how do you sleep at night?
And that was the only reason why
a little girl got taken.
And it took him a little bit, but that was the only reason why he said he came forward, is because he couldn't get Maria out of his head.
Well, I'm glad he finally did come forward, but
Damn.
Well, and I'm going to tell you the side note is that when it came close to Maria's or to G. McCurdy's trial, he actually backed out as a witness. So he testified as a witness in Gene McCurdy's preliminary hearing. Mm-hmm. But he ended up telling police when they contacted him before the trial, I'm not testifying. So wow. Police went to his house in Visalia. First, they called him. And he's like, no, I'm not testifying. Don't come to my house. So like, Gene, we're going to come to your house. If we have to stay there all night, we're coming to your fucking house. So Gene's like, no, don't bother to come. Well, police went to his house. And when they spoke to Gene, or sorry, Gene. Was I saying Gene the whole time?
Yeah, you were.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. I knew what you meant, though. So
Michael Jackson. So when they went and spoke to Michael Jackson, he told police that he had actually filed a workman's comp through his work for like his back or something. And some investigators from Kings County, where Lemoore is, you know, located, had filed charges on him. And this was after he came forward for Maria's disappearance as like seeing Gene McCurdy kidnapper.
Mm-hmm.
So he, not being trusting of law enforcement, believed the two to be linked, which is why he was kind of hesitant in the beginning.
Yeah.
So again, there comes that mistrust with law enforcement and thinking that they're just going to
screw him over.
Correct. They're going to just distort his narrative to make it into their own.
Right.
So then police and investigators, knowing they have some more work to do, they go to those Greenfield apartments that Gene lived at the time.
Yeah.
And they start talking to his neighbors, right? And they find a neighbor that was romantically involved with Gene McCurdy. And she said that when they first moved in and they were neighbors together, they literally shared walls in the apartment, that they had a run-in, they had a date night, and they were sexually involved that night. And she found out very quick that Gene had very specific sexual tastes that were incredibly aggressive. And she said that she couldn't meet that sexual appetite of his.
What does that even mean? I mean, I know we can get into a million different things, but let's not.
Yeah, I didn't want to get into specifics.
Yeah.
But specifics of what he liked, they later linked to like the way that Maria was sexually assaulted.
Okay.
But she wasn't uncomfortable because it wasn't your traditional sexual practices. Right. So she said that she knew she couldn't satisfy Gene's sexual like tendencies.
Mm-hmm.
So she basically told him like, hey, let's just be friends. So they were friends.
Okay.
Well, this neighbor, her and her mom were really into porcelain dolls, and they would order porcelain dolls, and then they would kind of like get together and like talk about this porcelain doll, right? Super weird, but whatever. So on the day of March 27th, 1995, when Maria went missing, her mom came over because a porcelain doll had came in. Well, when her mom came over, they did whatever they did. And then her and her mom, like, were just hanging out in her apartment. Well, her mom comes back from the bathroom and tells her daughter, Jean's neighbor, hey, does your neighbor have a child? And she's like, no, he doesn't have any children. And she's like, oh, I hear a child whimpering in the apartment. Well, then investigators talked to her mom, who collaborated the same story. Now, the next day they reported on March 28th that they saw Gene going through the back door of the residence and that he was carrying something like kind of like a bag that was really heavy. And he was struggling with this bag to the point where they were like, hey, you need help. And he was super adamant, like, no, don't help me. I got it. And they said like he was literally dragging it to his truck.
Wow.
You know what's upsetting about this is why didn't they report this? Like, they knew he didn't have a kid. They hear a child whimpering in a bathroom. And they didn't report this.
100%. Yeah. It was only when police like went and looked for these witnesses that they came forward and told it.
Well, also, like, I think we're jaded where, you know, a lot of people, they're still ignorant, you know what I mean, towards little things like that. They don't think anything bad in the world can happen. I know a lot of people.
I wouldn't say ignorant as much as like naive.
Say like ignorant is bliss. That's what that's what I meant. Like, I wish I could go back to that point almost, you know what I mean? Because nowadays, like, I think everybody's a bad person almost, you know what I mean?
100%.
But around my kids and stuff.
If she reported it, that little girl could be alive right now.
So I'm going to say...
Maybe, but how many other kids... I don't know. I mean, I could play devil's advocate, but... Yeah, possibly.
So when police went and talked to other neighbors within the complex, so they talked to neighbors on the other side of Gene's apartment, And they said that Gene was really weird. So he would come up to him because it was a man and a woman that lived in that apartment. And he would be like, hey, I heard you guys last night. And they'd be like, oh, we're really sorry. Like, we'll keep the TV down. And he's like, no, like, I heard you. And he was talking about like their sexual involved, you know, like sexual events with each other. And then they said that it just came off as really creepy. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Gene, as they found out when they searched his apartment complex and his mini store, not his apartment because his apartment was moved out, but they, when they searched the mini storage, they found tons of pornographic movies. Now, this is something really weird too. Now, when they searched, they said he had thousands of porn VHSs, right? A lot of the VHSs with porn had porn, and then they had like cartoon snippets put in, and then porn, and then chunks of cartoons in it.
Like he would tape over?
No. So they were saying that a lot of pedophiles, they do that because they'll have the kids watch cartoons, and the kids are used to cartoons, and then they'll see porn, and the porn is associated with the cartoon, so it makes them more acclimated to pornography instead of the shock value of it. Yeah. So that's what they said. They said that pedophiles do that a lot.
It's disgusting.
And they found a ton of those VHSs in Gene McCurdy's mini storage. They wanted to go and search his apartment complex, but obviously he was already moved out when he went on deployment.
Right.
And the apartment complex literally cleaned the place for him. Everything was bleached. They even changed the carpet out. Like, so there was not one shred of evidence in his apartment. Now, these apartments that said that Gene was really weird, they did report, and Christina, you're going to be really mad about this, that they did hear a blood-curdling scream from his apartment on the night of March 27th. And they said, like, all of a sudden, they just hear this blood-curdling scream, and then the screaming just stops. And at first, they thought it was the TV, and then they were like, I don't think it's the TV. But when the screaming stopped, like, you don't know where it comes from.
Yeah.
But in retrospect, when investigators start asking you about it, that's when you kind of connect it, you know? Yeah. So I really can't be mad at him for that. So now that they have this evidence from his neighbors at the Greenfield Apartments, they start looking at the shower curtain that they find upstream, right? And the shower curtain is like a peach colored shower curtain, and it has like these like weird patterns on it. And then they had these specific, they even had like the shower curtain hooks that hooked to the curtain rod still on it. And they were kind of like a burnt orange colored. So investigators take pictures of it, and then they grab the shower curtain, and they end up finding out that Gene was previously deployed in Washington. And so they fly up to Washington, and they are able to locate Gene's roommates at the time that he was deployed up in Washington. And the roommate's a couple, a man and a woman. And they start talking to Gene, and they find out that Gene...
They started talking to the investigators.
Yes.
Yes.
And so.
Sorry, I threw you off.
You did throw me off. I'm sorry. I keep
sorry.
So they started talking to the investigators, started talking to the roommates, and the roommates basically told the investigators that Gene was really like, he really enjoyed children, and children actually were really drawn to him, and they would come and sit on his lap oftentimes. Which brought me back to Donna Holmes, because Donna Holmes reported to investigators that there was times when Gene would come to her house and hang out with her kids, and she would catch him trying to get her kids to sit on his lap. And she would stop it immediately, obviously, because she was so freaked out by it.
Yeah.
Now, they didn't think anything of it because they didn't know anything about Gene's past. So they were able to identify the shower curtain when investigators showed them the shower curtain. They're like, yeah, that's a shower curtain that Gene had when he lived in this very apartment complex. He had it in the downstairs bathroom. And the investigator showed them a green speck of paint that was on the shower curtain. So then they show investigators a paint can of when Gene painted his furniture green. And it was the same exact paint color as the speck of green that was found on that shower curtain.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So they let them take a piece of that paint and take it back to California with them, because obviously it's a huge piece of evidence.
Yeah.
Hey, kudos to them to go that far to go, you know, for a shower curtain.
Yes. And then kind of side note, but that bowling ball that they found, the only way they were able to link it to Gene was Gene did call himself an avid bowler. The bowling ball was like I think they said like a 10 or 15 pound bowling ball, which is a child's bowling ball.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that Gene often taught 4-year-olds to bowl when he went to Kern County. because he would visit his family. His parents lived in Kern County in Bakersfield, and he would visit them every weekend, which was another connection to like Poso Creek where Maria's body was dumped.
Right.
So on January 21st, 1997, Jean's trial began. Donna, Jean's sister, took the stand, and it was so crazy when she took the stand and she testified against Jean, and she was really specific about like a lot of the sexual attacks that Jean put on her. But then Jean's parents from the defense's side took the stand, and Jean's parents claimed that they had no knowledge of any sexual assault, that Donna was just looking for attention, that they felt that she was just jealous of Jean.
What the fuck?
Yes. So then,
some fucked up parents.
Yeah.
100%.
You know what I mean? Like,
so then Michael Jackson takes the stand. And as we talked about, it was a huge ordeal to get Michael Jackson to even take the stand for the trial. So when Michael Jackson takes the stand, he points Jean out in the courtroom as saying that's the man he saw on that at the Food King shopping center on March 27th of 95. Now, when the defense comes up to cross-examine him, the defense attorney says, "Did you take Maria?" And this sets Michael Jackson off. And he starts pointing fingers at Jean McCurdy and he starts screaming, "He took her." And then he starts telling them, "Your mustache and receding hairline can't hide your fucking lion eyes," pretty much. Yes, because he's so incredibly emotional about it. He talks about, like, they even said that when they showed him Maria's picture in the courtroom, like, he starts crying. Because he has such a, like, a huge guilt because he didn't come forward, he said.
I would have the guilt as well.
Yes. So this trial lasts about a week before jurors were left to deliberate. And on January 31st, they came back with a verdict. So Jean McCurdy was found guilty of first-degree murder, kidnapping, and lewd and lascivious acts on a child. And then on February 13th, 1997, he was sentenced to the death penalty.
Good.
Yeah. So currently, Jean McCurdy resides on death row in San Quentin State Prison in Northern California. He did have a recent appeal in 2014 in which his sentence was upheld. He's currently 61 years old, and it's been officially 26 years since little Maria walked across the street to get a can of tuna. She would be 34 years old today. And I think it's an incredibly sad fucking story. I think that Jean McCurdy should burn in hell.
Yeah.
I hope that he gets what he gets in prison, because I also do truly believe that 26 years is too long to sit on death row and that you should be done already.
Absolutely. I feel like justice has not been served until he dies.
100%. 100%. And Jean's parents still stand by him to this day, like declaring his innocence.
As a mother, and if I was Maria Pacino's mom, I would hope he would die when I'm still here. You know what I mean? 100%. I don't know if she's still alive or not.
She is.
I would hope to see that before I go.
I think something that made me mad was I was reading an article that said that Jean McCurdy's parents referred to him as Jesus, like he's being crucified for like a greater good. And that very much so angered and frustrated me. And then another side note, and I didn't mention, was that Jean McCurdy took the stand for himself in his trial, right? And he admitted to all the sexual abuse he did with his sister, which his parents denied. But the only thing is he said that it was mutual. It was like a consensual sexual encounter. I just feel like that should be noted because...
It still doesn't make it okay, though.
Yeah,
100%.
You know what I mean? Like, fuck.
But it just shifts the whole thing from, like, rape, I guess. But he was older than her. So I think they were about 2 years apart. So he was older than her.
Still.
Yeah. To me, this guy's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
And police truly believe that he was, that this Maria wasn't his first kill. Because, okay, for our listeners out there, because we kind of didn't wrap up the little, the end of Tracy Renee Conrad, the little girl that went missing in Hanford. She was walking to her friend's house. She ended up being found in the backyard of a house, and she was in a kiln. And they ended up arresting a man by the name of Kevin Gaelic for the murder, and little Tracy Renee Conrad was actually walking to that house to go play with his sons. So he was arrested, just as I know we kind of briefly talked about it, and I don't want that to be, you know.
Well, we'll probably cover that on a different
podcast. You think we should? Okay.
I think it deserves coverage.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I just didn't want, because I know I mentioned it and kind of being a part of the case, but, and then another side note that I would like to mention is I was looking up, that little girl, that 10-year-old girl that went missing in Visalia at the swap meet. Mm-hmm. And right now they're actually doing the Parabon, which is like the genetic evidence of like, finding out like the ethnicity and age and possible like facial features of like who took her. Cause there was, DNA evidence found on her after her sexual assault, and they are linking it to a Hispanic man that took her, they said. So they're actually going forward with her case as a cold case and trying to solve that. And I'm hoping that's that awesome. We find a resolution to that. Right now we don't have one, but that's just something interesting.
Right. Wow.
And that's the story of Mary Pisano. That's how Lemoore turned from an incredibly safe and wholesome town to, you know,
overnight.
Yeah. Just a, you know, terrible place to be. I know, Maria Pisano, like her kidnapping gave me nightmares. I remember playing in my front yard and anytime a car drove by, I would fucking go run and hide because I felt like I was
going to get kidnapped. Well, between that and your uncle. I mean.
Hey, shout out to Uncle Bill. You're the real MVP of me being safe.
Well, you know, I want to say the billboard was up for even after they found out where she was at and when they found her body, it was up for.
I feel like it was up for 20 years.
Yeah, it was.
I'm up not for even a while. Bullshitting. Like, I feel like it was up. It might still be up. Like, her picture's not up on it because it's faded, but it was up for years after. I think they put up once they found her. I was reading that they put up some like really. It was a really well written quote about her being in heaven or something, but they didn't take it down when they found her.
Yeah. Wow. Crazy.
Yeah. I just think the intricacies of the story and the way that, you know, because if Donna Holmes had never came forward, right. How would they have ever
linked the two?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. It's crazy how things unfold.
Yeah.
But it goes to show, like, if you see something, just call the cops.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, or you hear something, just call them.
Yeah.
No matter how petty it is. You know, even if they don't even go check it out, at least they have it on record, you know?
Yeah. I think everyone's just afraid of kind of looking stupid. And in retrospect, when it's a little girl's abduction, it's easy to say that. But when it's,
right.
You know, you feel like you're wasting somebody's right. time, it's like another thing.
Well, there's always, so I've had this with neighbors and, you know, their kid goes missing for a little bit and they're like, well, they were just playing around the block. I don't want to call 911 right now, you know? I'm like, then call the non-emergency line. Every police department has one, so call them.
Yeah.
But, like, if your kid's missing, of course, or you hear something, just call 911. Big deal. What's it going to hurt?
Yes.
I don't know. When it comes to my family, like, I don't mess around. Of course, I'm going to do that. If I'm somewhere and hear something, like a screaming or something like you said, yeah, that's...
I don't know. I hear screaming all the time in my neighborhood. And you can't tell to me. You can't tell the difference between his kids screaming because they're, like... playing or having a lot of fun or being fucking murdered.
I don't know. I think there would be, you would know that one. Yeah. I think you would know that one.
Maybe there would be. I don't know. Because I know I hear kids screaming down the street a lot.
Yeah.
And to me, I think in my head, like, oh, it could be one or the other. But right. I hear it all the time. Obviously,
the kids still I hear alive. Kids screaming all the time too, like playing and, you know, yelling and stuff like that. But I feel like it would be a different, like, you would know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Would be frantic. I hate going to the store, and if I just turn my head and my son or my daughter are not like right next to me because I want them by me, and if I don't see them, I'm like, you know, I start freaking out. I'm like, yes. Where? And I start like yelling their names.
Where the fuck are my children? Start accusing everybody in the area of taking them.
Yeah.
I'm the same way. I'm super high alert. I think because we, you know, this is something that we're a little bit more privy to than the normal public. It's something that's a heightened sense for us.
Yeah.
And we're probably overly protective, but it's just terrifying because I'd rather be overly protective than not. And the worst would happen.
Yeah. I don't want to live with that.
No.
I don't ever want to deal with it.
No. 100%. No.
That's a parent's nightmare.
Yeah. So I'm just going to let you guys know, I don't know what to cover next week. So if anybody, any of our listeners have any suggestions within the next day or two of hearing this, let me know. Christina and Patrick, if you guys have any suggestions.
We actually did get a suggestion from somebody.
Oh, did we?
On our Instagram.
I want to start covering, I think we'll come back to like local cases, but I want to kind of start covering like further cases and touching on everywhere in the United States or even out of the United States.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll touch Canada.
Have you ever heard of the Aaron Valenti murder?
Uh-uh.
Okay, so that's one of our listeners recommended that one.
Maybe we can look into something. I had quite a few listeners too. Well, just not even listeners before even when we just announced that we were going to have a podcast that had a lot of suggestions, but they were all local. So I am so down to come back to those local cases in time, but I don't want to do a ton of like local cases.
Right.
Yeah.
Like back to back to back.
Right.
I got one suggestion. It was from my sister and I can't remember what the girl's name was, but it was basically a girl who ended up hiding her pregnancy, killed the baby when it was born, and then she ended up going to trial and she was found not guilty.
Oh, wow.
Which is ridiculous. Like,
Spoiler alert.
I know. I guess we can't do that right now.
Well, that case is done.
That one's solved.
We know.
Well, there you guys have it. You guys got two cases in one.
That was easy. Good job on your case.
Well, there might be more to it. Where
yeah.
A lot of the times, like, we can just, like, obviously this one, like, we obviously knew Maria was going to be found dead, you know, which is sad, but there's the intricacies of the case that, you know, listeners want to know. So.
Right. And there's a lot of good cases in Australia. And I say good cases, they're all murder, so they're sad.
Oh my God, yes.
But there's like Australia's fucked up. Like there's some fucked up people.
Some of the best cases come from Australia. Like they just have some crazy fucking people. I don't know what it is about Australia. It's the fucking spiders. That's what it is.
I don't fuck with. Yeah, I could never go there ever.
We went on vacation one time. We met a couple and their kids, and they were from Australia. Yeah. And I thought we were actually Facebook friends.
No. Some of the nicest people I've ever met are from Australia, but maybe they're just nice because they're all serial killers. No, there's a lot of serial killers. There's a lot of murders, like gruesome family murders and stuff that come in Australia. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe there's cases. There's a lot of couple murders. So there's a lot of the like murders where like the guy like abducts tons of girls and rapes them and kills them in their house and the girlfriend's okay with it. Like there's several cases.
We're probably thinking of the same podcast too.
100%. 100%.
Yeah. I've already listened to that.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Shout out to Morbid.
Yeah. I love Elena and Nash. Morbid.
Yeah. Yes. It's, you know,
Morbid's our favorite.
My only podcast I listen to besides ours. Yeah. That's definitely
They're a competition
goals.
Guys. They're not your favorite no more.
No, they have to be.
No.
No. We're all one loving group.
Yeah. Cause maybe we can be on their show. Or we can be on.
Oh, yeah. We could do co-hosts. Mm-hmm. That would be the day. Elena and Asha are over there okay.
Who the fuck are these guys?
Yes.
Who the fuck are these guys?
Talk to you in a couple years and you're on our level.
Ash, I cuss more than you. So can I get on that show?
This one was definitely significantly longer. I think we did a lot. It was a lot more research and coverage for this case.
Yeah.
What'd you guys think of it? Like a lot of twists and turns and fucking just crazy ass shit like the whole way.
Well, obviously I knew the story, but I didn't know all the facts or all those different leads. I had no idea.
Well, and there's shit tons more to the case. Like I could have definitely made this case a two-part episode. But if for whatever reason, I just kind of took the meat and potatoes of it. But there are a lot of intricacies that I did not mention that I could have gone on forever.
And I just can't believe that I never heard of this.
Me too.
Ever.
Yeah.
You know, too. Especially when I was young, I never heard any of this.
Oh, no. This is what sparked my interest. This is what changed little Brittany from being scared of the monster under her bed to the rapist under her bed. No joke. Like, this is the case that turned it for me. That made me realize there are fucking horrible ass people out there.
Yeah.
And they're preying on children. Yeah. And I think it's just different when you hear about it versus like when it's so close to home.
Yeah.
Then it just kind of, it's like the bitch slap of truth. Like, no, this could have been you. Like for me shopping at Food King, this could have been me.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, obviously I'm not going to the store to get a can of tuna by myself, like because we didn't live near the store, but it could have been me if we did. Who fucking knows? Yeah. You know,
well, you guys, the second episode is a wrap. I can't believe this. Sorry.
Are you getting excited? That sudden?
No, seriously.
Oh, I thought she was just ending it. Like, hey guys, this is too much talking.
We're going to have to just wrap this up. All right. We're going to have to get off.
I'm super pumped about this episode.
Yeah.
No, it's like, very good.
It's much better than our first one, in my opinion.
Well, we'll see. I'll have to listen to it. I've listened to the last one a million times, but.
Yeah. I'll send it to you guys before I post it.
Well, to all our listeners out there, thank you for listening. And like I said, if you came back from the first one, then, you know, fucking cheers to you. I'm sure he's in my White Claw as we speak. And I'm Brittany.
I'm Christina.
Yeah, and I appreciate you guys all listening. And this is Patrick.
Heard of a murder.
See you guys.
Bye.